Today is Sunday, the 25th of October, 2020, and I apologize to the people listening from the United States. We changed the clock here so that at the present time there's now only a six-hour difference, which means it's later in America than it usually is. But we have no control over the clocks. If I had my way, I would totally abolish daylight savings time. And if you know when they're turning the clock back here, our politicians are absolute amei ha'aretz, boors, einam yirei chet. They can have long beards, with beards, black clothes. They don't know the basics of Yiddishkeit. It's being changed literally one day before the Seder. And all of you know the whole purpose of the Seder is to keep the youngsters awake. And here, they're making the daylight to the sunset, the Seder, 1 hour later. Yomo, don't go away. If anything happens here, I need you. Yomo went to change the clock here. Okay. Pardon my maledicting the politicians, but Asicha ve'ekali, we'll put it that way. I want to mention a few comments. First of all, you may all recall from the Talmidim, we have a Talmud Mufak for many, many years, Steve Breslach, and he had some health problems. Thank God he's holding his own, doing a little better. I just want to tell you, he has published a Sefer, the first Talmud of mine to publish a Sefer on Steve, the hostess with the mostess. Shabbos begins on Sunday. Cookbook by Stephen Breslach. And it's really amazing. I've eaten at his home a number of times, many times I should say. And there's no one like him, and now you have it in print. All his famous recipes. Kol hakavod. Following up the article in that appeared in Ami, so I understand there were a number of letters to the editor afterwards, and as I just told Rav David Miller, halavai I should live up to what was written about me by students 40, 50 years ago. But one of my dear students from that period reminded me that when I was teaching the class in Michala in the, probably talking now, early 70s, mid-70s, and I would deal with Kicha Kicha, Mistei Ephron, about how we learn out Kinyan Kesef by Kedushin, Natati Kesef, Kachmi Meni, and we learn out from there, Kikachi Shisha, Kicha Kicha. So I would say to the class, Kicha Kicha, Mistei Levinger. And when Miriam Levinger died, it seems these students who still keep in touch with each other, their grandmothers many times over today, all commented, Kicha Kicha Mistei Levinger. So I'm happy I was able to leave that impression. And for me, it was Maskin Ishkachat. Also, I want to mention what I've told you all along, that Matzah Pesach becomes stale bread. An etrog, Shmini Atzeres, becomes a poor imitation of a lemon. So a wonderful student, Dr. William Gewirtz, emailed me, and he tells me this is a true story. A classmate of his at YU became an insurance adjuster, and he lived two blocks away from Bill Gewirtz. And about 45 years ago, the insurance company gets a claim that 1,000 etrogim were destroyed. Maybe there was a fire, I don't know what happened. And he's claiming $40 an etrog. So this claim came to his desk, and he checked the date that this person claimed the etrogim were destroyed was the fifth day of Sukkot. Anyway, the claim was settled at 15 cents an etrog. Not $100, but not $40 an etrog, but 15 cents an etrog. And that's exactly my point. By the fifth day of Sukkot, it's on the way to becoming a lemon. Finally, I just want to say to Rabbi Reuben, we discussed earlier this week, Yitzchak and I, the whole question of Atein Talumato that we began saying last night here. And I just want to mention that this V'tein Talmud Levracha, why did they establish it in Israel 2 weeks later? So you all know, to accommodate the many pilgrims that came to Eretz Yisrael from Bavel. So what do we see from this? That there were thousands and thousands of pilgrims who came, if not tens of thousands. Not one word is mentioned in Chazal about Yontif Sheni. If you're worried about the rain, Binyamin, that it's raining, and when do you say V'tein Talumata, Alach Ad Kama V'Kama, you have to talk about Yontif Sheni. This is an ironclad proof that there is no Yontif Sheni in Eretz Yisrael. And what I just cited now is the Chacham Tzvi, and I can tell you, these ears heard from the Rav when I discussed this topic with him in 1978 in Boston. Rebbe said to me that in 1935, when he visited Israel for the one and only time, standing for the chief rabbinate of Tel Aviv, that year, Shavuos second day fell on Shabbos. So Malacha was not a problem, but how do you daven? And his father told him, you're an Eretz Yisrael, you're an Israeli, you daven like the Israelis. And his father said to him, Chabichet from Tata, I heard from my father, Reb Chaim, that Kenim at Nishta Emfet HaChacham Tzvi. No one found an answer to this tremendous proof that the Chacham Tzvi brought. And this is almost, I would say, irrefutable. That if the Gemara never discussed Yontif Sheni for the same people who was worried about the rain, then what does it show you? In Eretz Yisrael, it's one day, and that's what the Chacham Tzvi Paskin, and of course, that brings us down to the contemporary issue. All right, I want to go further today, and as I said last week, today's shir is not just for today, it's for tomorrow as well, and it's a very fascinating shir, and it reveals the depth of my classmate, Reb Chaim. Being the Rav's son is not an easy task, I can assure you. And I stand in awe of how much Reb Chaim knows and what he accomplished in life. And what perhaps is an interesting comment, that here is Reb Chaim Soloveitchik, who lives around the corner from Stephen Glaser. He's listening to Stephen Glaser, so he should know Reb Chaim lives around the corner from him when he's here in Israel on Rehov Tayas, Rehov Neely. Could be he lives on the same street with you. So here's a man who's a great Talmud Chacham, great in Wissenschaft des Judentum, and could be his greatest achievement was in the world of sociology. I don't believe he was a trained sociologist, but once you have a good mind, so the question comes up in the Mishnah Halacha, Chelek Yud Alef, Siman Shin Pei Hei, with the Frumkeit began in Borough Park, that people were taking scales into the Seder. It's not the scale that Jack showed last week. I know the scale, Jack. Actually, there's one here that was outside the office of Torah Tshraga for years. I don't know why. My daughter has a scale like this. When you're on a strict diet, it's a little scale, and you can measure food on it. You can weigh food. So imagine you're going to weigh the matzah. Is it the right amount? You're going to weigh the lettuce. Is it the right amount? And they asked Reb Menashe Klein. I heard he's opposed. And he is vehement, adamant, that this is not Yiddishkeit. You're never required to weigh with a scale. Lo nitna Torah l'malachei hasharet, as I said to you about the square in the tefillin boxes, look into the Aruch HaShulchan. And this is not required. You have to know what your father did, your grandfather did, and you do like Klal Yisrael. And he was adamant in this feeling. What's fascinating, and here I ask Mark Lich to make a trip into Borough Park to go to the Yungabara Shtibel and see whether Reb Menashe Klein's son knows that Chaim Soloveitchik totally, completely, and absolutely agrees with his father. And what I'm quoting from is probably the most famous issue of tradition, although I have to say there were issues in the 70s where they published articles from the Rav. I don't want to say Chaim, you know, is more important than his father, Morenu v'Rabbeinu, but this is a very important issue. Ruption, reconstruction, the transformation of contemporary orthodoxy, it appears in Tradition, Volume 28, Number 4. 1994, it's 26 years ago. And here, Reb Chaim gets involved with what happened after World War II. After World War II, to paraphrase Chaim's article, Yiddishkeit is wiped out. All the Lithuanian yeshivas are gone. All the Hasidic courts are gone. 6 million Jews, Al-Kiddush Hashem, I don't know if the majority was Shema Torah Mitzvot, but there's no way to deny that a very large percentage of the Jews who were killed were Shomrei Torah Mitzvot, the Hasidic masses, the Lithuanian masses. All right, we all know the Holocaust. It's for us living history, at least my generation. Either we went through it or we went to school with endless survivors. It's living history. We were taught by endless survivors as well, let's put it that way. So Chaim makes the point that because of the Holocaust, there was a total rupture. We lost contact with the earlier generation. The livable pair, the ongoing Dola Doya Shabbach Masecha, was cut off. And as a result, when people started becoming religious, and remember, the few that survived, the minimum that survived, a few hundred thousand, half a million, reached America, reached Israel, they were determined to continue tradition, but remember, their children never saw their grandparents. I was a fortunate kid that I had grandparents, I had aunts, uncles, I had so many friends, classmates, who basically had no relatives. You all know that many of the survivors used to say we were a generation that had no grandparents, had no relatives. So this was a total rupture. And then when the reconstruction began, they had to start from scratch. And Reb Chaim's thesis is that instead of the oral tradition or mimicking their parents, their grandparents, everything became the written word, books, pictures. And it all began in the Haredi world, and from the Haredi world, slowly but surely, it reaches what we call in popular language the modern Orthodox world, the centrist world, call it what you wish. I'm writing now, and I had a lot of trouble. I used the word centrist finally. I don't like the word modern Orthodox, as you know from the Ami article. But how do you describe where is from is anyone? I consider myself frummer than the Haredi world, 100% frummer, absolutely. But how do we describe ourselves? So, all right, the YU world, the OU world, the Young Israel world, that world, call it the centrist world. So Chaim says that whatever begins in the right-wing world, slowly but surely, reaches the centrist world. And let me quote from his article. Most of the fundamental changes have been across the board. What has been a stringency particular to the right in 1960, and Benjamin, look how he describes the right, a Lakewood or a B'nai Brak Chumrah. And he says, to take an example, we shall later discuss She'urim, minimal requisite quantities, and he's referring to matzah, measuring, we'll talk about it yet, has become in the 1990s a widespread practice in modern Orthodox circles and among its younger members, an axiomatic one, meaning they'll look at a guy like Rakefet, what, you don't measure your matzah, you don't measure your lettuce leaves? What are you, a sheikis, an oisvaf, a pushtak, a bum? They can't even start to understand my generation. The phenomenon was indeed most advanced among the Haredim and was found there in a most intensive form. However, most of these developments swiftly manifested themselves among their co-religionists to the left. the time gap between developments in the Haredi world and the emerging modern Orthodox one was some 15 years at the most. And that's a fascinating comment. It's open to discussion how long it takes from a chumrah in Borough Park to reach Washington Heights, or how long it takes for a chumrah in Bnei Brak to reach Rehov Palmach in Yerushalayim. And Chaim says 15 years, give or take, give or take. I think he's essentially right. I always used to say it takes 10 years, a decade. But all right, 15 years makes sense. And on this article, what I just quoted from was on page 64 and page 65. But now I want to quote from page 68. And he explains himself that because of this rupture, we have endless books. And he says, what am I talking about? I refer rather to the publication on Talit and Tefillin, works on the daily rounds of prayer and blessings in synagogue and homes, tomes on high holidays and Passover observance, books and pamphlets on every imaginable topic. And what he's referring to here is, and I've often, called attention to this, I'll give you the simplest example in the world. Go up one flight from where I'm teaching in the classroom, go up one flight to the conference room. In the conference room, you'll find bookcases and svarim. A number of svarim I brought there, Rabbi Miller brought, others were donated by a Chabad. We once had a student here from a very illustrious Chabad family, and he studied here for a number of years. He was not well, and we accommodated him. He died young, by Yira Tzadik, and the family donated books. Among the books, you'll see two recent editions that were donated. About 1,000 pages in two volumes on a kippah. And how much is in the Shulchan Aruch on a kippah? A sentence or two, the Ramak, Mashal, what is there? You can do all your research in the world on a kippah, and you quote the Gemaras. Rabbi Yosef Weiss, my Rebbe, Zecher Tzadik Livracha, my beloved Rebbe, wrote an article in Jewish Life, it has to be in the 50s. Maybe there were four pages with the sources from the Gemara and the Milsa Chasidot. And all right, could you imagine today you have over 1,000 pages on a kippah? Ribbono shel Olam, you take muktzah. How much is there in the Shulchan Aruch on muktzah? Today, entire volumes on muktzah. You'll take Cholamoid, Avodin Cholamoid. How much is there in the Shulchan? Entire volumes. You see, there was a rupture. In the past, you asked your father, how big is a kippah? When do I wear a kippah? An Ashkenazi got one answer. Someone in Germany got a different answer. When Ashkenazi, I mean East European. Someone in Germany got a different answer. Someone in Morocco got a different answer. But today, everything spelled out, Al Rachel Bitcha Haktana. And Chaim says, this is a result of the rupture. We now have a reconstruction which focuses on the written word because we lost our grandparents, we lost our aunts and uncles, we lost that entire generation. All right? This is a fascinating point that he makes. And he goes on and on describing in Bnei Brak and in Borough Park and to a lesser degree, but still very real extent in Kiryat Shmuel and Tinuk, religious observance is being both amplified and raised to new rigorous heights. And here he comes for our topic. And the best example of this, and also one of the earliest ones in minimal requisite quantities required on Pesach evening, one is obliged to a minimal amount of matzah, a quantity equal to the size of an olive. Jews have been practicing the Seder for thousands of years, and no one paid very much attention to what this shear was. One knew it automatically, for one had seen it eaten at one's parents' table on innumerable Passover eves. One simply did as one's parents had done. And here you come along and you get a gift. They're raising funds from a day school, from a yeshiva. You get a gift in the mail, a sheet that you fold out, and it shows you how big the matzah has to be. Place the matzah on hand, on the sheet, and the sheet is marked off. Ad kana hand matzah, ad kana machine matzah. Then you get a sheet on the leaves of lettuce, how much lettuce you have to eat. Place the leaves here, and it tells you ad kan. And this is the rupture, this is the reconstruction, and Chaim views it as a sad commentary, a realistic commentary. But oy lanu shehiganu ad zeh, that we have to measure the matzah and measure the murrah. We don't have parents, we don't have grandparents, and here Reb Chaim just take it and publish it as an appendix to Reb Menashe Klein, word by word, emotion by emotion. Both of them are speaking on the same level. Now, just to give you a reward for tuning in today, and to those in America that have to stay up, and it's at 3 in the morning in New York, it's 2 in the morning in Chicago, so I'll tell you a story. I've told it before over the last generations, decades of teaching, but I'll repeat it again. And this too is a true story that I'm privileged to know from the family. At one time in Boston, remember, in the foreign ministry, Orthodox Jews had a very hard time. By the way, in the foreign ministry, if you go into it, it's very difficult raising children as well. I don't want to mention a name, but there's a very prominent family where the man was Zechel Levracha, a top individual in the foreign ministry, a tzaddik in his practice, and he raised kids going from this place to that place, and believe me, they didn't turn out what we would like them to be. A lot of controversy, both the son here, the son in America, etc. So it's a difficult task. I now can tell you they're actually charediyot in the foreign ministry. It's beyond words. Women whose husbands have to follow them, and they're charediyot. And it's, I don't know, we'll see in 30 years if they have more success with their children, etc. So in Boston, at a certain point, it had to be in the 50s, in the consul, the Israeli consul, there was one member of the Israeli staff who was a frum Jew 100%. And this was rare at the time. And he used to come to the Rav Shayurim. And he became friendly with the Rav. And the family told me, at one point he comes over to the Rav. Rebbe, I'm living it in Yiddish, I'll try to say it in English, if not I'll translate. Rebbe, Chav Gevelb Slani Barich Ba De Tzveta Seda, Ba Mies Nish Dantiv. I'd like to be with you at the second Seda, Chvil Zenvi, the Rav Pravit the Seda. I'd like to see how the Rav conducts the Seda. Imagine the chance to be at the Rav's table. And it's like Chabad, if you know Simchas Torah, all the Israelis on the Israeli consul in New York drove up to 770, it was Simchas Torah for the Israeli, it was Isru Chag. They drove up to be at the Rebbe of Havkofet on Simchas Torah. I don't want to get confused again between Shmini Atzeres and Simchas Torah, Israel and America. So the Rav Sadavada, certainly I invite you to come. So he comes to the second Seder, and he's in heaven. The Rav is saying Divrei Torah, answering questions. The children are bothering him. And the Rav, and he's watching everything. And then the Rav comes to Matzah and Murrah. And And the Rav starts with briska chumras, what, how many you have thieved, the shear, and how many matzahs, and I don't have to tell you, you wind up eating two full matzahs, ultimately even more, between the mitzvah matzah and the korach, and the mora, and so this guy takes a bite of matzah, like when we make a motzi, we take a little bite. So the Rav looks at him and says, Name, ich paskin, as du darfst at zweite seder, du sitzt da in Boston, the Rav Paskin is like the Chacham Tzvi, you're sitting here in Boston, you eat a second seder. So the Rav was makpid, he should eat the same sheyurim that the Rav ate. And they say his stomach went on the bum, he couldn't eat for a few days afterwards, he was on prunes, Pesach, that was all he could manage after all the sheirim of the Rav. So this point is well taken. We saw our parents, we saw our grandparents, and I personally do not use the sheyurim. It always bothered me. Lo nitna Torah l'malach ha'asharei. Today we don't weigh it. We don't have a right to weigh it. Maybe we'll see from a tribunum. There may be an iser and yontif. Are you allowed to weigh? All right, but there is l'dva mitzvah. It could be you can min kenadosh krichin. You can crawl out of it with a tshuva here, a tshuva there. But today, to put it on the paper, Vic, it's certainly not a shayla of weighing, of measuring. So intuitively, I feel like Rav Menashe Klein and my classmate, Rav Chaim Soloveitchik. Now, I want to pause for a moment and move sideways. And this is not anything to do with measuring and weighing. But I want to, everyone calls attention to what I just spoke about in Chaim's article. I want to call your attention to another part of the article. And I personally am very in debt to Reb Chaim, because if you go back to recordings of me for the last 62 years of teaching Torah, 62 is correct, if you go back to recordings, you'll hear me talk about this. But I never knew how to articulate it. And beginning on page 98, I think Chaim here is sheer genius, how he puts it together. And I'll tell you what I'm referring to. I grew up in the Bronx. I davened in Yeshivat Rabbeinu Chaim Ozon on Arthur Avenue. Again, it's unless you're from my generation, it's very hard for you to understand what the Bronx was like. Over 700,000 Jews, and I don't know if you had 10 families that were Shema Torah or Mitzvot. Total assimilation. As I told you more than once, Shabbos afternoon, my neighbor in the big building I lived at, 2115 Washington Avenue, a European man who came to America perhaps in the 20s, and he would come home from work Saturday, you worked half a day, and would make Kiddush, have Suda, and I would go over to his house and we'd learn Gemara together. And I mean, those Shabbos was rampant. It was like the air you breathe. No one had a concept of Halacha, Devar Hashem, and even where people felt Jewish, but there was such a breakdown. So it's amazing, in Yeshiva Ben Chaim Moshe, the shul was built like a European shul, the European shul. The women were a long flight upstairs. And Shmini Atzeres, Tfilat Tal, you cannot believe the way these women were crying. I remember Tfilat Tal. I remember there was a lady there, Rebecca Strauss. Were they crying? Were they praying? And take a look. We're supposed to be from Jews. I can tell you, Aaron Rakefet Davin, the Shmini Atzeret here, in a tent set up by Chabad outside Ohel Rivka. I davened at the 6 o'clock minyan, Shmini Atzeres, all right, the Hakafis were nothing this year. Then we come to Tfilat Tal. Tvetain, oh my gosh, Tvetain Talumata Levracha, Mashavaruch, Morid Agashem, and Tfilatal, and all that goes with it. I would say the whole Tfilatal took 3 minutes, not more. And just think back to the Bronx. These women, their husbands probably were working. Who had a kid who was Shomer Shabbos? Could be on the schut of the Tfilat Geshem, I should say, not Tfilat Tal. We just had some confusing Pesach with Sukkot. But Tfilat Geshem, we just said Tfilat Geshem could be in the schut of what they said. They have grandchildren, great-grandchildren who by some miracle woke up and came back to their blood veins and what Torah and Yiddishkeit and being a Jew is all about. Could be they had a miracle. I remember one time I represented the OU at a hotel here for a conference of the World Zionist Organization, something similar to what just went on by Zoom. And I remember people are checking in, and I see this grandmother checking in, and her granddaughter meets her at the check-in. Her granddaughter is going to be there for Shabbos, and the woman says to the lady, giving her a room, we need a room, the lady says, near the, you have an automatic elevator on Shabbos? Yes. And she apologizes. She said, my daughter became religious. The grandmother is apologizing because the granddaughter who's going to be with her became religious. But you see, could be they have a schut that they said Tfilat Geshem and Tfilat Tal with such kavana, with such tears, for look into an old machzor. You see, there's enough to say there for 35 minutes, for 40 minutes. And Aaron Rakefet, who's supposed to be a frum Jew teaching Torah in Yerushalayim, his whole Tfilat Geshem was maybe 3 minutes, with a whole kehillah of each one is a shame dava, who davens at old Rivka, each one at that minyan outside in the tent. I can tell you who they are, what they are, how famous they are, and upgezakt, upgedaven, lebracha, v'lo leklala, v'chulu, finished. So, I never understood. I could talk about it. I could talk about it. I could comment on it. I could joke about it. I could laugh about it. I could cry about it. I still remember Rebecca Strauss. I'm going back more 70 years to my childhood, more than 70 years. And Reb Chaim here is genius. And in this article, he's talking about the eruption, reconstruction. He continues on page 98. And you see Chaim, and he was raised like we were raised. You know, he can be a Soloveitchik, but he was raised in Brookline. He was raised in Boston. He was raised in Roxbury before. In 1959, I came to Israel before the High Holy Days. Having grown up in Boston and never having an opportunity to pray in a Chadei Yeshiva, I spent the entire High Holiday period from Rosh Hashanah to Yom Kippur at a famous yeshiva in Bnei Brak. Now, I'll fill you in. What it means, 1959, Binyamin, that's when we graduated college. Graduated college, his father gave him a gift, his parents gave him a gift, a trip to Israel. All right? What's the Haredi yeshiva in Bnei Brak? Panovich, I can tell you. I mean, I don't have to guess. I know, I remember Chaim was in Panovich. But obviously, it's famous yeshiva in Bnei Brak. There's only, when you say famous, it's Panovich. Okay. The prayer there was long, intense, and uplifting. Certainly far more powerful than anything I had previously experienced. And yet, there was something missing. Something that I had experienced before. Something perhaps I had taken for granted. Upon reflection, I realized that there was introspection, self-ascent, even moments of self-transcendence, but there was no fear in throng Jew in the throng student body, most of whom were Israeli born. Nor was that experience a solitary one. Over the subsequent 35 years, I have passed the high holidays generally in the United States or Israel, occasionally in England, attending services in Haredi and non-Haredi communities alike. I have yet to find that fear present to any significant degree among the native-born in either circle. The 10-day period between Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur are now holy days, but they are not Yamim Noraim, days of awe, or more accurately, days of dread, as they have been traditionally called. And what Chaim is saying here is perfect, perfect. Rupture and reconstruction. These ladies in Arthur Avenue, on Arthur Avenue, Tfilat Tal, Tfilat Geshem, they still remembered Europe. They still remembered their youth. They were crying. They were filled with tears, with passion. They understood what rain means for the Jewish people, for the land of Israel, which is the focal point of our prayers. But their families, everyone was out of Yiddishkeit. But when they davened, they were davening the way they were taught in the Alter Heim, in the old country. And Chaim hits the nail on the head. Today it's reconstruction. I never davened in the old country. I never davened in the Alter Heim. I never experienced that. We can be the frumest people in the world. Panovich, American born, Israeli born. Reconstruction, holy days, Yamim Kedoshim, but not Yamim Noraim. We lost it. And in our reconstruction, that awe, fear, trepidation, we have not reconstructed. And I have to say, coming back to my earliest exposure to the great people from Europe who came to the United States, conversations with Reb Chenich Fishman, he told me exactly the same thing. He says, we felt the fear on the street, said, back in Mir, Briz, Chaydish Elul, began a whole new feeling. No, what's Chaydish Elul for us? Sure, we blow shofar, we say the Davar Hashem Ori, but I never saw anyone shaking. The Balei Musa used to say, even the fish in the sea shake during Chaydish Elul, during Aseret Yemei HaTshuva. And you see, that feeling we lost. I still remember the Balei Musa. I heard this from Rabbi Yaakov Moshe HaKohen Lesson. I heard it in Lakewood from Rabbi Lesson Wachtfogel, who spent years studying in Europe, and Rabbi Yaakov Moshe HaKohen Lesson was a product of East Europe, and they describe what Yom Noraim meant in Europe. We lost it. We don't have it. We've reconstructed. No, we're from. I heard shofar every day. Chodesh Elul. I heard shofar on Rosh Hashanah. Even my wife goes to hear shofar. Chabad blew all over the place this year. In at least Kiryat Shmuel and Rechavia, I can testify. On every street corner, they were blowing, stopping people on the street. Total chiloniyim. Shamatim shofrayam, rotzim lishmoa. And they would blow 30 kolot. What a schut they have. My Litvish mind doesn't comprehend it. As a Litvak, I feel like saying, you rotten, vicious, malicious, hideous, heinous, brutal, depraved, degenerate, debauched, surreptitious individual. You didn't go to hear shofar this morning? Forget it. We don't have to plead with you. Chabad's attitude, you take a Jew, one more mitzvah that you can do for him. You've brought one more mitzvah into the world. But wow, Reb Chaim hits the nail on the head. I grew up in a Jewishly non-observant community and prayed in a synagogue where most of the older congregants neither observed the Sabbath nor even ate kosher. They all hailed from Eastern Europe, largely from Shtetlach, like Shepetovka and Schnippeschnuck. Schnippeschnuck, I can tell you I was in. It's a suburb of Vilna. If you visit Vilna, Schnippeschnuck today is part of Vilna. So it's not the... This was adjacent to Ir HaKodesh, Vilna, and most of their religious observance, however, had been washed away in the sea change, and the little left had further eroded in the new country. Indeed, the only time the synagogue was ever full was during the high holy days. Even then, the service was hardly edifying. Most didn't know what they were saying, and bored wandered in and out. Yet at the closing service of Yom Kippur, the Ne'ilah, the synagogue was filled, and a hush set in upon the crowd. The tension was palpable, and tears were shed. What had been instilled in these people in their earliest childhood, and which they never quite shook off, was that every person was judged on Yom Kippur, and as the sun was setting, the final decision was being rendered, who for life, who for death, who for tranquility, and who for unrest. These people did not cry from religiosity, but from self-interest, from an instinctive fear for their lives. Their tears were courtroom tears, with whatever degree of sincerity such tears have. What was absent among the throng students in Bnei Brak and in other contemporary services, unless I be thought to be exempt of myself from this assessment, absent in my own religious life too, was the primal fear of divine judgment, simple and direct. And I have to say that, in my humble opinion, this is the height of rupture and reconstruction. What Reb Chaim has articulated here is the heart of this rupture and the frailty, lack of deep understanding, the infrastructure of our reconstruction. Excuse me. It's very moving for me because for so many decades, generations, I carried with me the image of Arthur Avenue, Yeshivat Rabbeinu Chaim Oiza, Tfilat, Geshem. And you think of today in Israel, in the rabbinate in America, could you imagine trying to have the people in Maplewood, South Orange, say Tfilat Geshem, Shmini Atzeres, 40 minutes, impossible. Israel, 3 minutes, 4 minutes. If I want to be generous, 5 minutes, but not more. And this is the rupture, this is the reconstruction. And I have to tell you, Reb Henoch Fishman, I believe I write this in Washington. Reb Henoch once said to me, and remember, an American kid growing up in the Bronx, 700,000 Jews who saw Shabbos, Kashrut, what a total, Echtaret Mishpachas, abgedeckt, you can't even talk about it. So Reb Henoch said to me once that there were as many Jews in shul on an ordinary Wednesday night in Mir as they were in on Yom Kippur. And I have to tell you, as a kid, I couldn't believe him. I found that it was impossible. An American kid from the Bronx, you're telling something like that. I remember in Maplewood when the Yom Kippur services ended, unfortunately I would get up and announce, "My dear congregants, the next prayer session in the shul will be next Rosh Hashanah," give the date, and with a straight face, everyone smiled a little, laughed a little, but I think they understood very well what I was saying. You know, when I found out and finally could understand what the Penich was telling me about, when I came in Aliyah, go into the Shtiblach on normal times in Katamon, and I think you have more people there on a simple Wednesday night with all the minyanim than you have on Yom Kippur night. Jack, what do you say? Simple Wednesday night, Jack agrees with me, shaking his head. That's when I write this in Washington. That's when I realized Reb Chenich was absolutely correct. But this is the rupture, this is the reconstruction. Why is this so important? First of all, for tomorrow's shiur and everything we're going to be doing for the months to come, the swing to the right. The Rav was never totally happy with it. Binyamin, if you managed to get a copy of the two volumes, The Rav, The World of Rabbi Joseph B. Soloveitchik, written by a guy named Aaron R.R. Don't want to mention.
Excuse me? Got Washington yesterday.
Got Washington, huh? Kala Kavod.
I need to do that first.
Okay. The Rav is, as far as I know, it may be out of print now. They did about 5-6 printings. It's a sad story as far from my point of view, because the publisher just disappeared on me. You know, they sold out, and I never saw another statement again since it reached the Israeli owner of how many books were sold, what's owing, but what's the difference? Money is money, that's not important. But in volume 2, I quote the Rav speaking at Sheva Brachas. What's interesting about that work is that Rakefet only wrote one part as his, the monograph on the Rav's life. It's about 90 pages or whatever, 100 pages. Everything else in the two volumes is the Rav speaking for himself. The genius of the author is how he put this all together. And he will tell you, if you ask the author, with Mini Shemayim, you got to read Washington to see what he writes there about how this book was written. Is it appreciated? No, but it'll be appreciated more as time moves on. That's the way the world works. So I write where the Rav speaks in the holes of home. He lets his hair down. And he tells you how unhappy he is with the swing to the right. And he gives examples, not important now, but if I can interpret what the Rav is saying, it's exactly rupture and reconstruction. What bothered the Rav is we took the format, but we didn't take the soul. You follow? And that's why we have all this enmity today between Jew versus Jew. We have people teaching at this very moment that YU is no good. This one will say Satmar is no good. This one will say Lubavitch is no good. This one will say Panovich is no good. Each one has their own. And Rakefet says they're all good. But add a heart, add a soul, add a depth. Torah is Torah mit Ibegegebenkeit, totality. There's no such thing as being half pregnant. Either you're pregnant or you're not pregnant. Either you're impregnated with your love of Torah, your love of the Jewish people, your love of the land of Israel, the romance of being part of this great people. That's what we're lacking today. Yeah, Shem Shabbos, Kashrut, Metalik Yidurim, beautiful mikvah today, but the heart, the soul, and this is what I think, if I understood Rebbe correctly, this is what he was relating to, and this is rupture and reconstruction. I'm proud to tell you, just to put this into parentheses, so when the Rav was published, people challenged, how could this be? You know, everyone interprets the Rav as he wishes. So people who are more right, that the Rav has put it up, Rakefet made it up, all right? So I clandestinely made the tapes available. I gave the tapes to Milton Rabbi Nordlich, and he publicized them. Oh, the people, they came crawling on their feet to me. You're right, the Rav said this, it's word by word. You didn't even edit the English. But rupture and reconstruction. All right, So it's important for the Monday class, and it's important here, you'll understand now, the next tshuva I'm going to quote from Menashe Klein, Reb Menashe Klein, you'll understand his attitude. He really is also writing Rupture and Reconstruction. Simply, he doesn't articulate it in the sociological sense the way Reb Chaim articulated it. And here, I want to quote from the Mishnah Halachot, Chelik Yud Gimel, Siman Ayin Aleph. And it's a follow-up. Very, very interesting. The first tshuva I quoted was Chelik Yud Aleph. This is two halakim later. This tshuva, let's see if there's a date. No, yes, we have a date here, 1989. And it's written to our Rav Aaron Zakai, who is a Talmud Chacham, and it's written Svarim, and Yedidi, Harav Agon HaMefursam, Rav Aaron Zakai, etc. And he says that you wrote how important it is to have everything measured. The matzah, the amount of wine, the morah, and you should weigh everything and prepare it before Pesach, Erev Pesach. You'll see why I'm citing that. And he says, I heard that Reb Menashe Klein is opposed. And Reb Menashe Klein goes crazy, extreme. He says, I am totally opposed. I have complained about this for years. The Torah was never given requiring a person to weigh and measure. And he says, just the opposite. Weighing and measuring is a curse, a klala, a malediction. And he quotes the Gemara in Shabbos, Daf Lamed Gimel, Amud Aleph. What's the Gemara? Where the Gemara talks about all the punishments that God sends to the world. And Betzoret, a drought, B'nei Adam Ochlin V'ein Esfeim. It's one part of the punishment. You eat, and you're not satisfied. Okay? What does it mean you eat, you're not satisfied? Could be you don't have enough food to eat, or could be you're eating the wrong food. But then he says, V'ochlim lachmam b'mishkal. People who have to break bread and weigh the bread. And here the Gemara refers to the Pasuk in Vayikra Chafav, Pasuk Chafav, Bishivri in the Klala, Bishivri Lechem Matel Lechem, V'afu Esa Nashim Lachmechem B'tanur Echad, V'cheshivu Lachmechem B'mishkal, V'achaltem V'lo Tisba'u. And Reb Menashe Klein quotes the Mefarshim. What does it mean? The women are breaking bread. They have such little flour. The bread falls apart. And they have to divide up. It's 10 women baking together one loaf of bread. And because they're so zealous for their bread, they weigh it, that each one should get 1/10 of what's available. And lo aleinu, this klala came true. All of you know the stories of the Holocaust, the death camps, the labor camps, what it meant to have a little bread. Lo aleinu, what a story, what a sad fulfillment of this klala. But Reb Menashe Klein, who went through the Holocaust, went through the Shoah, who saw this and experienced B'didi haviyuvda. He is furious here. He says to weigh matzah is the biggest klala in the world. And he says, I am totally, completely opposed. I don't understand people who do this. He said, and I saw people doing this. And he says, chas v'chalila, that this is not the way we Jews are required to live. And then he says, if we will weigh the matzah before Pesach, people will forget, and they'll weigh the matzah on Pesach. And as far as I can see, this is an isa gomor to weigh and measure matzah and lettuce at the Seder. And then once again, I mentioned this last time in the previous tshuva, he says, I'm well aware, the Achronim, you are familiar with, it goes back to the Noda B'Yehuda, and it goes into the Chazon Ish, and Nitmahatu HaSheyurim, and he quotes Rav Haigon. This is why all Sheyurim were given vegetables, eggs, concepts that are tangible, that don't change. An egg is an egg, a kezayit is a kezayit, a beitza is a beitza, and this is all we measure by. Things that we eat daily, that we know, that we understand, that we saw our parents, we saw our grandparents, and he says, don't tell me about the Achronim. Rav Haigon, his fingernails are bigger and more important than all the Achronim that you can quote, that all the Achronim that you can cite. And he's adamant in his position. And he says, this is the way we have to live. All the Dorot live this way. And we have to continue until Biat Mashiach Sitkenu. This is the Jewish way. This is the Torah way. And he absolutely refuses to countenance what Rav Zakkai has suggested. Baruch Hashem, we have scales today. We can measure, we can weigh, we can take a diagram. Chas v'chalila, kezera eva kadesh. What my parents did, this is what I do. But this is Rav Chaim Soloveitchik, this is rupture. This is reconstruction, this is the new generation, this is the new world, and between Reb Menashe Klein and Reb Chaim Soloveitchik, we have a very interesting challenge. How do we go back to a world of emotion and understanding? Yiddishkeit should not only be laws and letters and books, but a living tradition with smiles, laughter, tears, and at times crying. It's a tremendous challenge. I think this is where our chinuch fails. In the state of Israel today, I don't have to tell you, a lot is being written about the percentage of Hasidim who leave Yiddishkeit, the percentage of mitnagdim, and above all, the percentage in the Tzioni Dati world. Part of it is a reflection of the homes. You got to remember, the average kid going to a Haredi education, a Hasidic education, comes from home. So he sees Yiddishkeit at home. When you go to the Tzioni Dati world and the religious public schools, which are, let's say, 30% of the educational system, 25%, you're dealing with many children who don't come from homes. But the parents want them to have some feeling of Yiddishkeit, some understanding of Yiddishkeit. So to begin with, the kid is not coming from a frum environment. That's part of it. But another part of it is, yes, we succeed in transmitting information, but not warmth, not feeling, not pride. Without that, The Western world is challenging us. The computer is at every corner. It's in our hands. We can't budge without it. Who knows what the world will be like in 25 years? Sea changes are happening before our eyes. It's hard to conceive. Forget about Corona, how many changes the current lifestyle will have brought and will remain with us. But the whole change to artificial intelligence, to Elon Musk and all that he's dreaming about, who knows where we'll be at. But with all that, it's Yiddishkeit is not just books, not just facts. Love, feeling, emotion, pride. I am a Jew. I am a Torah Jew. I am part of a magnificent people. We have so much to be proud of. Thank God I can continue. I can contribute. And this is what we're lacking. And I believe Reb Menashe Klein and Reb Chaim Soloveitchik with both sign on the dotted line. Yes, Binyamin. Wait, give me 1 second. Baruch atah Adonai Melech Haolam,
she'hakol nihyeh bedvarav. Wasn't this rupture like essential? Because if this rupture and reconstruction didn't happen, then you would have people who their kids weren't even Shomer Shabbos. So yes, we're lacking that, but we needed this.
What? What are you saying? That
meaning those women in the shul were crying and they had the heart. They were Shomer. So I think
those women Dafka might have still been shown Shomer Shabbat.
Their kids, I'm saying,
but their kids, even their husbands. So what are you saying?
Yeah. I'm saying if we didn't have this rupture, then we would keep the heart. We would be crying in shul for Tzidkas Geshem, but the kids wouldn't. I think
what the reality is that the rupture and reconstruction are beyond us. There was nothing we could do to stop that. Hitler was Hitler, and all of Europe was wiped out. Everyone ran away. You ran to Palestine, or you ran to America, you ran to England, you ran to South Africa. There was the rupture. It was the only way to save our lives. The reconstruction is the challenge. So thank God we've reached the first level where, Baruch Hashem, today you have millions of Jews who are Shomrei Shabbos. Millions. But the challenge to me, to you, and everyone associated with Grus, and beyond us, in every yeshiva, is not just to give over information, but to give over warmth, pride, emotion, and recreate in new contents. In Dor, we're in a different generation, the emotion, the commitment that was 50, 60, 70, 80, 90 years ago in Europe. This is the challenge.
I think that's probably what Rabbi Weinberger and the Hasidus movement.
It's my student, of course.
That's what they're trying to accomplish.
Absolutely. And this is finally in Israel, a lot of people are talking about this in the Mamlachti Dati world. More warmth, more emotion. But you need great teachers. I mean, you got to remember, teaching, you're not getting paid $1 million a year for teaching. I would give a good teacher $1 million a year. You follow? But you're not getting paid like that. So many great people wind up being medical doctors, lawyers, etc., business, high finance, tech, the computerization. Believe me, I know what I'm talking about. But good teachers, where do you get them? How do you create them? Just can't go into a classroom. You have to go into a classroom with love, with understanding, with knowledge, with vision. Halavai, we should inspire the greatest teachers in the world, Alad Mata Kodesh. But that's the challenge, that's life. Life is not static, and life has endless challenges. Some people run away, disappear. Other people fight with dignity. Some of us win, some of us lose. It's not simple. This is the ongoing story, saga, of the Torah people before God and man. Okay? Mm-hmm. So we'll put it that way. But the Eish Kodesh Rebbe, absolutely, that's what he talks about. Warmth, meaning, all right? I hope he gives a little credit to the guy he studied with in BMT many, many years ago. Okay. Let me go one step further. Let me just check the time, okay? One more question on Pesach, which takes us back to relying upon a guy, relying upon a Gentile. And if you recall, this is what I told you weeks ago when we dealt with the original tshuva, if you recall, you have to sell the chametz. Time is ticking away, and the guy doesn't show up. So this is a real problem. In Israel, this problem probably doesn't exist because we sell to Arabs, whether some can be Druze, some can be Muslims. But because we Arabs and Jews live together, there's mutual understanding. In other words, you have intelligent Arabs who understand very well what Yiddishkeit is all about. There's a famous baker in Yafo. He bakes pita. It's a big Arab family, so their bakeries are closed on Pesach. And they explain they're living in a Jewish state, and they don't want to offend their customers, the Jewish people. They have Arab customers, but they have Jewish people too. So Arabs who need pita on Pesach can buy up before Pesach, put it in the freezer, take it out and put it in the microwave, and it's as good as new. But so there are many Arabs. I need not tell you what's happening now with the states, with Sudan recognizing Israel. I mean, we don't realize how much credit we have to give to Netanyahu and to Trump. My grandson visits us every Shabbos at 11 o'clock in the morning, and he was praising Netanyahu, and I told him, you're right, everyone is critical, everyone this, and what this man has accomplished, who could dream? And Trump deserves the Nobel Peace Prize, what he has accomplished. And I told people in America, you can criticize Trump, and he's this, and he's that, and have students who use negative words about him. And I tell them, for the state of Israel, what he did with Yerushalayim, what he did with the Golan Heights, what he did now, what we're headed for, wow. And they say there are more Arab states on the way. So it's very important. I don't think this will be a problem in Israel. An Arab understands this is the Jewish religion. An Arab lives here. It's a Jewish state. He knows about the Jewish religion, and he knows how important it is to us not to come at some Pesach. So you tell him to come at 10 o'clock in the morning or 11, 9 o'clock in the morning, the sale. Gesundheit, they're going to come. It's a publicity. Some of you see the pictures in the newspapers. They're selling the chametz of the state of Israel, the chametz of the post office, the chametz of the packages that will come in on Pesach. It's amazing. You see the shtarot and what they have. What about buying back the chametz? So in America, we had the question that Rabbi Shachter Sr., Rabbi Dr. Melech Shachter, who Rabbi Rubin always praises, he had a course with him in response to literature. So Rabbi Melech Shachter, who I knew intimately, I was with him at Pesach. I wanted to get the shemesh, how you sell, what you do, the kinyanim, and he arranged to sell it to the custodian of his synagogue in the Bronx, and he's not there. Turned out he was dead drunk, 10 o'clock in the morning. Until we got him, brought him up to the office, and I don't know if he knew what was going on, not going on, and this is some responsibility. 100 people have authorized you to sell their chametz. So we spoke about that case. Now, it's a different case. Mishnah Halachot, Chelik Yud Aleph, Siman Shin Nun Gimel. No date on it, and he writes Lechvod Harav Hagon, etc., etc. No name, Shlita, no name. I don't know what that meant. Maybe the person who asked the question was embarrassed. What happened to him? I don't know. Here's what happened: B'divas Shel Atoba Matzai Pesach Lo Ba Ha'akum Shemachru Lo Hachametz Bezmanenu Lachzav Leknot Mimenu Hachametz. V'haya shat hadachak ki haya hachametz shel rabim. V'sha'al kedat malasat. I guess this happened on the spot. He sent a messenger, went himself to Reb Menashe Klein. Could you imagine, you're selling chametz for hundreds of people, And here Pesach is ending, and you all know what goes on this Matzoi Shabbos, Matzoi Pesach, I should say, in Israel. Because of the corona, they pleaded with the bakeries not to bake, not to sell, because crowds, people run for chametz. All right, I'm very different. I could eat chametz, I could eat matzah all year, never taste bread, and I would have no complaint whatsoever. It's psychological with me, because to me, anything Jewish I love, b'lev v'nefesh, and matzah is Jewish bread. This is uniquely Jewish. So I can eat matzah all year, all my children laugh at me, my grandchildren laugh at me, but everyone runs right after Pesach ends. And you all know, we spoke about this in this class, if I don't know if this year, last year, people make Havdalah Matzoi Pesach on beer, that's brought down already, lahalacha. What are you saying? I can't hear. The Gra, Yomo says the Gon from Vilna, made Havdalah on beer Matzoi Pesach. All right, my attitude is, what's the rush? Baruch Hashem. Okay. Imagine the pressure. The guy doesn't show. Whatever that means, the guy doesn't show. This is a serious business. What do you do? And this is the question he got. So he says right away, Hinei lifnei kisrim chamesh shanim karamik retzleinu kein zem. He says, 25 years ago, I had the same problem. So it shows you that you have to have a guy who understands what chametz means, what Pesach means, what it means being a Jew. In Chutz Laretz, where do you find goyim like that? It's a non-Jewish society. What, even the most erudite guy reads the New York Times. He's going to learn about chametz and Pesach from the New York Times. And if he's a general person, he reads the New York Post, he reads Daily News, all right? No one ever got a bachelor's degree by reading the Post or the News. So what do you do? So Rabbi Asher Klein tells him what he did. He said, what did I do? That he took two witnesses right after Pesach when he saw the guy is not coming, and he figured out how much profit he would give the guy to buy it back. Let's say he'd give him $50, and he gave this money to another person in front of the witnesses, and he said, I'm being mezaka the guy, zaken li adam shaloba fun of, and this can apply to a non-Jew too. And he's getting a profit of $50. And he said to these witnesses, you are my witnesses. I'm doing this belev v'nefesh. Make a kinyan in the money for the guy. Zachen li adam shelo b'fanav. And with this, I have bought the chametz back. And he was matir for everyone to open up their drawers, their cabinets, and freezes and use the chametz. Now, the guy showed up the next day, ulamacha kishabacha akam, and they gave him, I said, $50, hayasvaratzimse. He was very pleased, very happy. So he gave that solution. In the second part of the tshuva, he says, I uncovered, when I looked into the Achronim, he says, I uncovered in the Eshel Avraham, he's quoted in an Achron, I believe this from Hungary, and he told the same story, gives the source here, and the Nachri doesn't show up after Pesach. And people don't know what to do. And he says, here, what the Eshel Avraham did, that he took two witnesses and he said to them, here, whenever the guy comes, I will put aside this money for him. And again, let's say it was $50. And if the guy is not pleased, we will give him whatever amount he wants. And with that, he permitted the Olam to use the chametz. So Reb Menashe Klein says, it would appear to me that either way it's good. The way I did it, where I actually gave the money to someone and Zeichem Dabne Shalom Befanav, or if, according to the Yeshel Avraham, I simply made a commitment in front of two witnesses to give the guy the money, and if not pleased with the sum, we will give him more, and in that sense, the chametz is usable. When the guy comes, we'll settle with him, but it's as of now that we're making the commitment to buy it back. What we see from here is takes me back to what I told you last time, Maplewood, South Orange, rabbi, tremendous responsibility. People authorize you to sell chametz. This means you could have millions and millions of dollars of chametz in your hands. If you don't do it properly, chas v'chalila, the whole problem of chametz she'avalav ha'pesach. Part of this chametz can certainly be be'en, not just the tarovet, not just the mixture. In the state of Israel, could you imagine what's involved in selling chametz? You're dealing with conglomerations, the food industry here. You're probably talking billions of dollars, not millions of dollars. And you have to be very careful to know that the Gentile you choose is reliable and understands. I went out of my way after seeing the case with Rabbi Schechter, Rabbi Dr. Melech Schechter. I went out of my way in Maplewood, South Orange. I always chose an intelligent Gentile, professors, principals of schools. But as I mentioned, I had a different problem. Every year, the person I sold the chametz to the year before passed away. It was like a klala. If Rabbi Rothkopf sells you the chametz, you're not going to survive the year. So, Kanayin Hara, the last few years, I remember I was blessed. I sold to my next door neighbor who was principal of the high school in South Orange, Maplewood, and Baruch Hashem, he lived to tell the tales. But the bottom line, Rabbi Grunstein, Yehoshua, if you're preparing students for the rabbinate, please impress upon them, selling chametz is not a child's act, a child's play. This is serious, and be sure you have a non-Jew who you can rely upon. Okay, let me just go one step further and introduce something. We'll deal with it next week, and we'll see something next week that is crucially important to dealing with Achronim and Shilas that come up. Very fascinating what I uncover of Menashe Klein. Again, I say this man is, besides his knowledge of Shas and Paiskim and Achronim and the Paskin, doesn't realize how deep a thinker he is, as you saw today with Ruption Reconstruction, and as I'll show you next week. But here I want to tell you an interesting story. The only ones who think they can learn when I grew up, where I grew up, and how I grew up, were the Litvakim, the Litvish. Remember, I've given many shurim on this over the decades in different courses. The Litvakim, Shas, Paiskin, this is learning, this is conquering the world. But other people, what can they learn and what can they learn? And all right, they have Bekiyah, the Chassidim, but davened up Gemara. That used to be the expression in the Litvish world, that they daven up the Gemara, like you say, Ashrei. Ashrei Yoshvei Vechtecha, and you know in Tells, if you know Yeshivat Chafetz Chaim in New York, they could spend a month on one daf, just digesting it and doing Rishonim and understanding it. Oh, what's involved in learning. And Chafetz Chaim was famous for that. And there they didn't even look into Rashi. They first you have to understand, say pshat, then we'll see the way the Rishonim learn pshat in the Gemara. But they looked at the Chassidish world, the other world, mendavendav. All right, this was true. On the yeshiva faculty in my time, everyone was a Litvak. Radin, Brisk, Mir, all right, Tells, different yeshiva. I don't say they felt every yeshiva was equal. Privately, one Rebbe would speak against another Rebbe, one yeshiva against another yeshiva. This is why I'm perhaps so interested in the Litvish world, and I have thousands of pages in my office prepared, God should spare me to give it, on the East European yeshiva shevelt. What were the differences? What was the little jealousy between them? But one thing was for certain, if you weren't a Litvak, the learning was not on the same level as far as they were concerned. What's very interesting is that the Galitzin world gave birth to one of the greatest, most innovative thinkers ever of the modern Achronim, and that, of course, is the Minchat Chinuch. The Minchat Chinuch, the Sefer Chinuch, the Minchat Chinuch. How many of you have learned the Minchat Chinuch? You have never seen a more prolific mind than the Minchat Chinuch. Rav Babad. Babad is Bet Aleph Bet Dalet. It's an abbreviation. Ben Av Beiten. I believe his first name is Yosef. If someone can check it for me, tell me if I'm right or wrong. You can fill us in afterwards when we unmute everyone. I believe his first name is Yosef, but check it out on the computer. Someone is checking in front of me, one of my Talmidim here. Yosef. Okay, so my memory, Yomo, my memory is good. Remember I said to you hours ago, is the name Yosef? My memory is good. Rav Baba, oh, let me tell you now, Bididenu Havi Uvda. The Rav had a certain gestalt. Teach something you don't know. I write about this in Washington too. Don't teach what you know. And the Rav said, look, to your students, it doesn't matter what you teach. They'll be gaining no matter what you're teaching. But if it's something new for you, you're gaining too. And believe it or not, it had to be right after the Rav's cancer operation, had a very serious operation, the end of 1959, as I recall. Early 60s, not well. Baruch Hashem, he recovered. It was mamish in those years, semi-miracle. And it humbled him to a certain degree. That's when the change begins, that he becomes less strident and less, I would say, makpid on absolute excellence in his Talmidim. He realizes we're only humans. He's a human too. It's interesting. So, the Rav came back, and that year we did Orech Chaim, we did, the Sfarim had been written on the Shurim, if you, I think most of Rav Kook put them out on Tfilin, on Sitz, we did Mamish Orech Chaim, Kriyat HaTorah, Rav did Kriyat, those were unbelievable Shurim. Then he did Minchat Chinuch, and for many months the Rav gave Shurim on the Minchat Chinuch. And I'll never forget what the Rav said. Mein Zeide hat machshi gewen a Galiziana for the Litvische Welt. Translation, my grandfather, Reb Chaim, koshed a Galician for the Lithuanian world. And what did the Rav mean? We all understood already. At that point, I knew a little bit how to learn. I wasn't a total Amoritz, only a partial Amoritz. Let's say 1960. I have notes on this. And what did the Rav mean? Very simple. That the Litvische world looked upon the Galicianas, Viken, and Zeglerin, and what do they know how to learn? Along comes the Minchat Chinuch, and he takes the Sefer HaChinuch, and I'll say a few words about the Sefer HaChinuch in a second, but along comes the Minchat Chinuch. You open up his commentary on the Tayag Mitzvah on every mitzvah, he asks questions. Havi aminis, maskanis, ibayaluhu. I can see it this way, I can see it that way. Is there any Lithuanian mind that equals the Minchat Chinuch? And Reb Chaim brought him into the Litvashe Welt. He already spoke about the Minchat Chinuch. He quoted the Minchat Chinuch. He praised the Minchat Chinuch. And this is what the greatness was. His prolific mind. What he could see, what he could question, what he could ask. Why are we talking about the Minchat Chinuch? Because the next shaila we're going to get from Reb Menashe Klein, his first source is the Minchat Chinuch, who asked this very question and what his approach is. This shaila will become very important for us because, as I alluded to before, in the last part of the tshuva, Reb Menashe Klein gives us a key to understanding what halacha is about. Jew standing before God. Reality. And I'll tie it in with the international dateline and Rabbi Nachum Kasha, as Be'ezrat Hashem you will see. Now, just a word or two on the Sefer HaChinuch, which I'll quote next week, what we're talking about. What's fascinating about the Sefer HaChinuch, first of all, we're not even positive who the author is. It's open to question. A lot has been written on it, particularly from the point of view of Chachmat Yisrael, Wissenschaft, scientific Jewish scholarship. But the Minchat Chinuch, Sefer Chinuch, this is a Rishon. And he takes every mitzvah, gives us klalim, also gives us philosophy, halachic philosophy. And in that sense, the Sefer Chinuch is very unique. Because this is not philosophy coming from the philosophical world. It's philosophy coming from within the halachic gestalt. We'll give an example next week when we discuss the issue. I have to say, and I'll end off with this, and maybe I'm right, maybe I'm wrong, but one of the greatest finds, when the Rav died or the Rav was ill already, they found in his drawer in Boston a manuscript he began, probably the early 40s, and he had a dream of creating a halachic philosophic framework, a philosophic framework based upon the halacha. He wrote the introduction. That introduction has been published, reprinted. I believe it's called The Halachic Mind, in contradistinction to The Halachic Man. And it's just an introduction of what he wanted to do. In that introduction, you see the gauntlet of the Rav, what he knew, general philosophy. It was all of what University of Berlin, what he had gained from his studies there, his doctorate there. And he was going, and that was the introduction. And then he was going to take the halacha and develop a philosophy of Judaism as a result, a derivative of Dvar Hashem Zu Halacha. And I saw one idiot who criticized the Rav that he never went further. Gentlemen, let me tell you something. In life, we can have a lot of dreams, but reality sets in. The Rav was in Boston. He was dreaming. He winds up commuting to New York. He winds up teaching at the yeshiva. He winds up Shas and Paiskim. Read volume 2 of the Rav, where the Rav talks about the debt he owes the yeshiva. He got so busy and so involved, and the heart of his life with the Sheyurim in the yeshiva, the Shas, the Poskim, the Reb Chaim, the Rambam, the Ravid, the Rabbad, the Ravid. All right. You have dreams of your youth, but then reality sets in. Ein adam meit, Chadosh Chazal put it, v'chatzi tavot b'yado. We don't achieve one half of what we dream about. Anyone who criticizes the Rav that he never wrote this work, yeah, go back in time, take the Rav and say, Rebbe, stop commuting to New York, stop teaching, stop raising students like Rav Aaron Lichtenstein and others, and we'll give you $100,000 a year, just sit and work on this volume. But life doesn't work that way. And it could be later in life you have a different sense of values. The Rav would have said, my philosophic work, let's depend upon what was written before by the Rambam and others, the Rabbi Sajagon. To me, teaching is the most important aspect of life. And as you know, the Rav spoke about that time and again, Ich bin nicht mehr wie ein Melamed, I'm only a Melamed. Okay, so to reiterate, first of all, I want to thank the students in front of me. I want to thank everyone on the screen. I apologize that I'm not looking at you full time and also looking at the classroom, but I have live students here, and as they say, they come first. I'm so happy to see everyone. I want to say personally to everyone, Chodesh Tov, Shavua Tov. We were in Kaddish Levana yesterday, V'tein Talamata Levracha. It's amazing how life is moving on. I also have to tell you, it's been a very hard week for me, a very hard time. The amount of death that hits me is beyond words. And I can just tell you, just this morning, I came out of my house. I'd already learned four different storim. Tanakh, Mishnah, Aruch HaShulchan, and I started my Daf Gemara, Baruch Hashem. And I throw my cane into the car and I say, I'm going to try to walk today without a cane. I feel good. And I say a silent prayer. I'm telling you, as it happened, it shouldn't be bad news this week. I had so much last week. And I walk 3 seconds to my neighbor, Professor Sam Dershowitz's car. He drives up to shul and I go with him to keep him company. I would rather walk because I need the exercise, but fine. Got to be a mensch. And I opened the door to his car. The first thing, do you know who died? And he tells me there's a notice from YU, Malki Shwaika died. I don't have to tell you. I practically fainted. Malki Shwaika, again, it's a name to you. Malki Shwaika and Myron Shwaika were both my students. Myron was in the first class I taught in Yeshiva University, 1962-63. He teaches at, or taught at Pardes, I don't know today. He's no youngster. He must be hitting 70 today. He was my student in 72-73. I put him on his feet. I love him. What a Talmud. Later in life, I have a student, postgraduate, Michalam Malki Schweiger, Malki Esch originally. Her half-brother, I cannot tell you how we're intertwined. Monty's half-brother is Bobby Esch. Bobby Esch and I grew up in the Bronx, were in yeshiva together. He's maybe a year or two younger than me. We ran our minyan at the Kotel together. Malki, what a sweetheart, what a student. More than that, her father, Esch, was married twice. His first wife died young. Bobby's from the first wife, Malki's from the second. My parents and the Ashes were friendly from Young Israel of the Bronx, I think it was called. When my parents came in Aliyah, we found a picture of Bobby Ash's parents with my parents in a rowboat in Cretona Park. I gave the picture to Bobby. He hugged me, he kissed me, he said, Arnie, I have such few pictures of my parents. It was precious to him. Then the father remarried, and Malki's from the second mother. Then the father died young, and Malki's mother raised her. You don't know what a woman that was. I knew when you do shalayim, a tzadeket, a melumedet, davening and learning. She was before her times. And Malki, what a daughter, what a mind, what ibegegebenkeit, what understanding of Yiddishkeit. And then I have to get the news. So Reb David just filled me in. She had suddenly a heart problem and they couldn't save her. And I'm so broken today. You have no idea. So, all right, I had other good news. My Talmud, whose wife was given up 2 weeks ago for dead already in Muncie, she's doing much better. Thank God. It's not that she's out of her bed yet, but she's in a long-term care center. She's off dialysis. She's way down in the oxygen. It's all that Don Corona. And she should only have a refuah shleima. Ruchama Pearl, they gave her an extra name, Ruchama Pearl Malka Leia Bat Chana Sarah. When you hear many names like that, it means it's a Holocaust second generation. Because the Holocaust survivors had so many people to name after, they burdened their children with many names. So I mitpaleh l'Kadosh Baruch Hu, please only give me good news this week. Yehoshua, you can do me a favor. And the YU announcement, there's no phone number or email for the Schweigers, for the Ashes. I can't be Menachem Avil in person for a number of reasons. As you understand, Corona is the main reason. Please send on to me an email so I can express my feelings, both by phone or by email, preferably by phone. And I want to just repeat, what did we do today? Well, we finished our Reption Reconstruction. We put it into context. I'm overwhelmed by Chaim's as a sociologist, what he accomplished here, all right? His Yenim also is beyond comprehension. One American kid, and you see the way he grew up, just an average American kid in Boston, and look what he accomplished with Yenim. But here with this sociological insight, wow. And he solved my problem that haunted me. Rebecca Strauss, Rivka Strauss, Arthur Avenue. Now I understand it very well. In addition, we said a few words of introduction, which we'll pick up next week with the Minchat Chinuch as part of the tshuva. And as I said, the most important part of the tshuva is what comes at the second half, where Reb Menashe Klein is overwhelming in his insight. Tomorrow, I wouldn't miss the shiur for all the ballots that are being cashed in advance, being voted in America in the current election. What we're going to do tomorrow, Be'ezrat HaNotein LeYov Koach, we're going to see a photograph of YU 1980, the swing to the right, and what's happening, what has happened. And that paves the way for the overwhelming machloket that continues to this very, very moment. And of course I'm referring to Synagogue Council, Board of Rabbis. I want to thank you all once again until we meet again in health and happiness. Das Vidanya. Morty, let everyone unmute. Good. Does anyone have any questions?
Hey, Rebbe.
Yeah.
Those that would like the phone number, I'm happy to say it now, or I could send it to you via email, whatever's easier.
No, send it via email. It'll be easier for me, and I won't make a mistake. Yeah, thank you. Are there any questions?
Rebbe?
Yeah. Nachum, yeah.
You said at the very beginning.
Yeah. Go ahead.
About the Taint HaLaMatzar, about the Babylonians going back to Babel.
Right.
It's also a point, if they were keeping a second, they had to bring a second Korban Pesach. But there's no way they could bring a second Korban Pesach. They'd show up at the Mikdash on the night after, the Kohanim would tell them
wait one second. You're saying they would have to bring a second Korban Pesach because of Sveika Diyoma?
I'll
tell you, Ad Kedei Kach. For instance, we don't fast 2 days Yom Kippur in Tinek. My wife would love that the Rabbanim should say anyone in Chutz Laretz has to fast 2 days Yom Kippur. Sveik de Yoma, Vahamevin Yavin. My wife is a very big Zionist. She's not a liberal Zionist like I am. I'm happy if they have grandchildren living here, but she. But no one mentions, that can't be to bring a second.
Then they could make a second Seder if they didn't have a Korban. You're right.
It's a more of a...
I saw something very nice that they said, it's a lesson for us that we really need rain, and we should start saying the day after, but as long as one Jew is inconvenienced, that one Jew has to get back to Babel. He's going to have a muddy road way too easy to sign how every single person counts, you know, for, you can't have your part until everybody counts.
So what you're citing is a proof to Chabad, that Rakefit is a nice waf, that he's mad at this Jew who doesn't give a hoot about making arrangements to hear shofar. And Chabad is absolutely right. Be concerned with every last Jew, with his soul. Blow the shofar for him. Don't rebuke him. Don't reprimand him. I got a lot to learn, but what can I do? You got to be true to your youth, to your upbringings, to your rebellion. Yes, Yoshua. Are you asking anything? Or no, that finger is just a picture. Okay, yeah?
As an alternative, if the goy doesn't show up another vehicle, I'm wondering, Rav Schwartz, you should have a Fuh Shalema, once said something to me about Hashivas Aveda using Hefker Bezdin Hefker. So if you're in a situation, aside from the vehicle we talked about today, could a possible alternative putting together a Bezdin, Hefker Bezdin?
I'll tell you, Hefker Bezdin Hefker, you're getting involved already with
He's finished, I'm just keeping it on.
Right. Hefker Bezdin Hefker, you're getting involved with Afkod Kedushin. Who can be Mafki Kedushin? Who has the power? Hefker Bezdin Hefker. You think you can form a Beitin in RCA Beitin? I don't know. But then again, Hefker Bezdin Hefker, it's not it's the guys. Do you have the power to make Hefker the guy's possessions? I don't know. I think the solution that Rav Menashe Klein gave is better. But the truth of the matter is, we beforehand have to find a guy who's reliable. I mean, this is... Or a guy who's nearby, someone you know you're going to be able to tap on the shoulder. Motzoi Chag. I don't even recall in Maplewood... Did the guy come to shul,
okay,
or did I go into his house right after Yontif? But I know you got to buy it back very quickly because people are dying to have chametz.
I think most people in the United States, most Rabbanim, they, or a lot from my experience, they use a guy that works, the secretary or...
Someone who works...
that has that connection.
Right, exactly.
Dependent.
Right, exactly. But in Maplewood, we didn't have, a little shul at the time. Today, who knows what's going on there? It's much bigger. But I used the neighbor, and that was my solution. But okay. Yeah. Anyone else? All right. Let me just...
Yes, Rebbe, if there's one more question, if I may.
Go ahead.
You mentioned earlier that on Simchas Torah Chutz La'aretz, all the Israelis that were in New York, the area came to Chabad.
Isn't that the Pachesia coming?
I can think of. I was wondering if you know any such head there. If no, why do you think they were invited
So first of all, on Chabad Fekminishkan Litvisha Shayas, that's number one. You don't know. But number two, I'm told they parked on the outskirts of the neighborhood, that it wasn't in the heart of the Jewish neighborhood. That's what I'm told. Whether it's true or not, I don't know. But that's what I was told. On the other hand, Chabad may have viewed it, Eit Lashot Lashem Heferu Toratecha, because getting these Israelis to come to Chabad, it had an impact, it had feeling. So you can look at it either way, but sometimes we have to understand the general good was worth more than perhaps a slight infraction. But I understand very well what you're saying. Don't misunderstand me. I've gotten the Shaila. People fly out of here on second day Yontif, and they arrive in New York. So I tell them, that's fine. But imagine you're going to Englewood, you're going to Teaneck. The airport is not a Shaila. But so they told me, no, by the time the taxi reaches there, it's after Yontif. All right, could be it's a Teretz von Bubba, it could be it's the reality. But this is interesting, an interesting question. All right, I want to wish everyone well.
I'll just share, really, very, very briefly, that I'll send you the article that once Shimon Peres was in America on a Tuesday, Sukkot was Wednesday night, and he wanted to fly back Thursday to Israel to get here before Shabbos. And the Rav Rashi, as we said, grounded him and said, no, you're in New York. You're in a 3-day yontif, tough. And he was there for the 3 full days.
All right, I'm happy to hear that Shimon Persky remembered who gave him a bracha when he was a little kid. You know who gave him a bracha? The Chafetz Chaim, his grandfather took him.
I'm not so sure that the grounding of Shimon Peres was by choice.
No, I understand. It's political implications. But he never forgot that he got a bracha from the Chafetz Chaim. And you know who his first cousin was? Who was Shimon Peres? Lauren Bacall. Was Lauren Persky from the Bronx. She was Shimon Peres' first cousin. Could you imagine what happens in America? And as you know, she lived the life of some sort of Protestant. She converted, raised her children that way, married to Humphrey Bogart, Hashem Yerachem Aleinu. She was a first cousin to Shimon Peres. Okay, until we meet again in health and happiness. Yeah, let me... You got to clear the room. What?
When I wrote about the shtar, have you heard of all where anyone had in the shtar where it said that it included anyone who forgot to tell
me? No, you can't do that in a shtar, Mechiret Chametz. It's not an Erev. An Erev, you have a right to say anyone in the city who forgot can be someone on my Erev. But those are people who care and want an Erev. But when you talk about a shtar Mechira, you're selling everyone's chametz. I mean, you need reshut. Zachen liyotam shlobafanev. So if that's the case, make one shtar for 12 million Jews in the world. No, that has to be an indication. Right. Okay, I never heard of that. It doesn't make sense to me that you can do that. Steve Breslau, I want to tell you something. Steve, at the start of this year, I showed your book, your achievement.
I saw it.
Okay, I want you to know we love it. We love it. Kol HaKavod, and it's done very beautifully. Yomo is going to contact you. He thinks you may be related. He's a Gachman, and you come from Hachman, so you may be related there. If you know Russian, it's exactly the same name. So we'll find out. That would be something if Yomo from the Ukraine is related to Steve Breslau from the Bronx. But Besofa Shildova, we're all B'nai Avraham, Yitzchak, and Yaakov. Until we meet again in health and happiness. Das v'danya. Thank you.